listening to the Sportageous Podcast, where sport gets smarter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Sportageous Podcast. I'm really excited to welcome one of the icons of squash who we have here in the studio with us today. Jenny Duncalf is a former professional squash player with a career high ranking of world number two. She's also a triple Commonwealth Games silver medalist and a gold and silver medal winner at the Women's World Team Championships. Having represented England in over 100 games, Jenny has traveled the world playing the game she loves. And more recently, she has become the new performance pathway coach for Squash Australia and now resides in the Sunshine State of Queensland in Brisbane. So welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Very yeah.
Kind intro, by the way. icon might be a bit far, but...
No, I think you're being humble there, but look, it's a pleasure having you on the show. And I wanted to start off by asking you, obviously, with we are all in a situation at the moment where the listeners, you and I across the world, can all understand and empathize with one another. What are you getting up to at the moment during these lockdowns? Obviously, Australia, us being in Australia, it's a lot better here, fortunately, than in a lot of other parts of the world. But what are you getting up to during the lockdown in terms of your fitness, but also just your general life?
Well, if managed to just about get into a routine, basically, so you've actually got something to do each day. And as you say, we are pretty lucky here in Australia. The best thing probably is the weather, so it always helps when you get up and the sun's shining, a nice bright start to the day, try and get some fresh air in the early morning. We've got a little outdoor area, and then the exercise is important. It can get pretty miserable if you're not training or exercising. I'm retired now, so I don't really have to exercise, and I haven't done it times since my retirement, but the last few weeks I've got into a good routine of just doing it's literally just 25 minutes, half an hour of work in the morning, but quite intense. It's a session called T25, and it goes on for I think about 12 weeks, and I think we're in week four, but it's quite good fun. Just in the front room, get Sean T, the guy on the TV, and go through 25 minutes of intense work just to start the day, and then it gets pretty boring, to honest. Just same as everyone, really, trying to do things around the house. And in Australia, you are allowed to exercise outside. I know in England it's just once a day, but we tend to do exercise at home in the morning, and then around about this time or early evening try and get out on the bikes down by the river. We found a little wall to try and play some squash against, which has been pretty good fun. And then we've also actually joined a tennis club, because in Australia, again, very fortunate, you're allowed to play tennis here. So trying to play tennis once a week, which is pretty ropey, I have to say. I'm not the best tennis player. Yeah. So it's not been too bad, but overall just trying to just be patient, really. I know it's so tempting to just nip out the house all the time, but kind of what you can almost pretend the essential things like going to the shops, but yeah, just trying to keep amused. And good time for podcasts. I've actually not been listening to any podcasts, but now I'm on one. I might have to start searching for some instead of doing jigsaw puzzles and things like that. So pretty much just trying to remain as active as possible and just get through the days and be patient.
Oh, absolutely. I can completely understand when, you know, you talk about the whole issue of people dealing with maintaining fitness and being able to do those things. And in terms of the podcast, I think, you know, when you are doing work around the house, it's the best thing to tune into and have a bit of a listen. So you can definitely look into those. I could give you some suggestions as well. But let's move on a little bit and go back to perhaps the beginning of your squash journey. How and why did you start playing squash?
Well, it's a long time ago now. I was 9 years old. Just a nine-year-old kid, loved all sports. My favourite sport was football, so soccer, as you call it here.
Yep.
And I used to play at the weekend for my local team, Weatherby. But I was the only girl in my team, And once you got to under 10 level, girls weren't allowed to play with boys in the team. So I had to leave the team, unfortunately. So that meant I had no matches on a Saturday. And my brother, my older brother, had recently just started playing squash with a friend. And we started going to junior club at Harrogate Squash Club on a Saturday morning because I couldn't play football. So loved it straight away. And it just started from there, really. Every Saturday we were at the club, and then my parents were at the club all the time, kind of socially. And we just ended up being at the club all the time, and just I loved the squash, and it went pretty fast from there, really, from those early days.
Sure. And just before we touch on the squash a bit more, do you support a particular football team?
I absolutely do, yes. I'm a Liverpool fan.
Oh, okay, so it must be
the worst thing about it. Obviously the worst thing about coronavirus at all. It's very trivial in comparison to what is going on in the world. But yes, hopefully we'll get our hands on a Premier League trophy at some stage.
I know you Scousers have been waiting for it for a very, very long time. So of course it is a bit frustrating, but hopefully I think everyone would rather sooner than later, even if they aren't necessarily Liverpool fans.
I think a lot of non-Liverpool fans are quite enjoying it.
So tell me this, Jenny, how much has squash changed since you started playing? I guess both in terms of playing style, but also technique?
Big question. It's changed. Well, there's a few ways it's changed for me since I started playing, or even not before I was a professional. Just the back in the day, the quality of players was amazing. You know, but it was, or geographically, it was mainly Commonwealth countries that played. So if you look at the ranking list now compared to 20 years ago, it would be, back then it would be on the women's like England, Australia, New Zealand, whereas now there's Hong Kong, Egypt, Malaysia, so many different nations play the game now, South America. So it's far more cosmopolitan in terms of nations competing and players. The other massive thing is obviously financially, the tour's so much bigger, the tournaments are so much bigger. I mean, when I first started, or even when I was topping around the top of the end of the world rankings, the biggest tournaments were kind of like $50,000 tournaments, and now you're looking at $500,000 tournaments. So that's two things. Yeah, the people that play it and the prize money these days and the size of the tour. In terms of the actual game itself, it's really hard to compare. Obviously, in the women's game, the scoring changed from traditional scoring to 9 and then to 11, which everyone panics about when it changes, but including myself a little bit. But you still kind of, the cream still rises to the top eventually, and it's just the scoreline change made for more exciting squash. You weren't stuck at handout 2-3, 3-2 for ages. I remember having really tough matches, and it was only 4-3 in the second game. Whereas as a fan, you obviously want to see the scoreboard to keep moving. And then there was the introduction of the low tin. So when you see the girls play now, the likes of Raneem, Shabini, Kamisa, Hania El-Hamami, just the athleticism and the movement and the pace of the game is on a consistent level in the sort of quarterfinals onwards, is from my era anyway. I love the sort of older era, people like Michelle Martin, Susan Devoy, Cassie Jackman, all those guys. Absolutely brilliant squash players, and I find it really hard to compare because it's so hard. But it's just different now in terms of there's probably a few more shots going in. Obviously, all the Egyptians in the game, to be general, a lot more creative than some of the sort of so-called traditional countries that play. But those countries and those players have had to adapt their style a little bit. So I'd say the pace is ridiculous, and just the athleticism, I think, is the biggest thing. And that's come from, I think, two things. One, Nicole David was leaps and bounds ahead of everyone else athletically. And then the low tin. So you had to be able to pick up your speed off the mark, and then you get used to playing those rallies and those explosive movements to get to the front of the court, and also there's more space to cover, obviously, with the lower tin.
Sure. It's interesting that you bring up Nicole David, because I was going to ask you a question in relation to the rivalry that you had with her in the late 2000s, and wanting you to sort of share a little bit about those tournaments and those finals that you guys played several of against each other.
Yeah, I get asked about Nicole a lot. With a similar age, she's only 8 months younger than me, so we started playing when we were young. Well, actually, probably about 12, British Junior Open under 14s,
yep.
Scottish Junior Opens, and then naturally, yeah, played a lot myself, her and on there, Abdel Kawi, were kind of all the same sort of age range. And yeah, it's tough, obviously. I've played her in World Open Final, Commonwealth Games Final, British Open Final, amongst others, so all my major final appearances have been against Nicole, and I've lost all of them, unfortunately. But at the same time, I'm not bitter about it at all. I'm kind of privileged in a way that I was very much a part of an era with one of the best ever, definitely one of the best ever squash players,
yep,
that's been. So I was, you know, maybe if she wasn't around, I might have won a couple of major titles,
mm-hmm,
or a gold medal or something. I might not have as well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm happy to have been up against her, and that was my challenge. I couldn't overcome it, but I got as close as I could.
Sure. And speaking of winning, what was it like at the Qatar Classic in 2010?
Yeah, that was my biggest win, my World Series win. So yeah, it was brilliant. I played Nicole. I beat Nicole actually in the semis 3-2, yep, which was a rarity. And yeah, I mean, looking back, I was playing pretty well. I'd won a tournament, to be honest, actually. I'd won a tournament in New York, in Brooklyn, a week or so before. And in the meantime, I'd done something to my arm. So I didn't really hit a ball in the ruck for a good few days in the run-up to Qatar. And so probably a little bit relaxed, and only hit my first ball once I arrived, and then got through the early rounds fairly comfortably, which you can't do these days, no disrespect to the girls that I played. But it's so much harder now. Back then, you in a World Series event, your first couple of rounds, unless you had an absolute shocker, you were pretty much going to get through, mm-hmm, until like the last 16 quarterfinals. So I beat Nicole in the semis and then played Rachel Brinham in the final. She didn't have the best day, and luckily I played well, so I managed to win that, mm-hmm, fairly quickly. And yeah, it was a big deal. Beating Nicole was massive in the semis, and then to actually... It's always hard to back up a big win, and it's so exciting to think that you've got this big opportunity. And so I was really chuffed that I could actually close it out. And then, yeah, I didn't know at the time, but that took me for, I think I was maybe 6 in the world, and took me up to 2 in the world. So yeah, it was a pretty good top, pretty good win. I was happy with that one.
Oh, absolutely. And would you, I know it's a bit of a cliche when it comes to this question, but would you say that was the highlight of your career?
It's definitely up there. I don't really have a standout highlight. I think I remember specifically being told on court that I was going to be world number 2 after that final during the presentation, and that was just a wave of emotion, because I had no idea. I was never great at, I never really looked mathematically at the ranking, so it was a big surprise to me and a really happy shock. So I always remember the elation of that moment. I remember winning my first British title. That was a big highlight. That was a massive highlight for me. And then I've said it a bunch of times, but I've always loved playing for England, and I'm kind of a bit of a team player, really. I've always enjoyed being part of the team, just being at the events as a team and winning for your teammates or your partner in a doubles match at the Commonwealth Games. They're all highlights for me as well, even though there's been some tough losses within those team situations as well. But Qatar's definitely up there.
Sure.
Top 2 or 3.
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, you bring up losses, because and this idea that, you know, you were not able to come back to that same height after that win. What is it like dealing with that pressure, and how did you overcome that and carry on playing? And what are the sort of, I guess, techniques or things that you would train yourself with to enable you to overcome that pressure and those expectations?
Yeah, it's a hard hard question, and one that I can answer very, very well, because the last few years of my career, I'm not really a very good loser, and I don't think I've ever been good at dealing with it. So the idea, if you have a bad loss, looking back on reflection, I personally think some of my losses when I was ranked highly, that was a bit too much of a big deal made about it. And I don't, whether that's from my own point of view or people around me, I think it's important that you look at the reason why you lose a match, but I don't think you should make mountains out of molehills either, and not get too down about it and think what's going wrong. Or, you know, if you have two dodgy results on the bounce, it doesn't mean it's the end of the world or something's happened and what's wrong with the player involved kind of thing. You've just got to go back to try and look at why you lost that match in particular, but don't just try and shrug it off a little bit, and remember why you enjoy playing, and go to the next tournament with your head up and get stuck in again. But it's easier said than done, because we're all competitive. And yeah, I struggled with losing. I didn't enjoy once the odd injury and other things come into play, and you do start having losses that you're not used to having. It's difficult. There's no easy answer, to be honest.
Sure. And obviously with injuries, it is never easy again to sort of overcome that. But how important, in your opinion, is the need for athletes, and in particular squash players, to look after their mental health and sort of work on improving and also focusing on it side by side with their physical health, which of course is far better understood in most sports? And do you think squash does enough in that area?
I think it's extremely important, and these days it's so much better than it used to be. I mean, I've never been the best at we were lucky in England squash. We had a lot of supports from the governing body, and we had psychologists available for us as much as we did with nutritionists and strength and conditioning and physio, etc. I didn't tap into the mental side of it enough. Not so much mental health, well, I guess it is really, but just sports psychology.
Yep.
Some players used it more, but these days it's pretty much the norm. And I think it's something that I should have facilitated a lot more in my career than I did. And I definitely think there's a huge place for it. I mean, if it's all about margins, like everyone says, professional sport is margins and very, very small percentages. And if seeing a psychologist as much as seeing a Pilates instructor can make you that 1% better, then that could be the difference between a world title and a runner-up, a tiebreak in the fifth. So it's very important, and I think everyone realises that now, and everyone's trying to get as much out of themselves as possible, and that includes mental health as well.
Absolutely.
And squash is pretty good. Yeah. PSA, now we have the PSA Foundation. It's been going for a couple of years now, and they're always looking at how to make players more comfortable and healthy. And it can be a lonely world, traveling the world, you know, playing tournaments when there's a lot at stake, prize money, ranking points. You could be lonely if you don't have many mates on tour. There's a lot going on, so it's good to have, we have like workshops at tournaments and to make us think about different things. And it's getting a lot better, and PSA are doing a good job.
Sure, absolutely. And Jenny, I want to move on to your coaching, but just before that, I have that one media question that everyone seems to always ask squash players.
You're talking about the Olympics, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I know that obviously the whole squash community.
I actually have my hands over my eyes right now.
I want to leave it as open and uncontroversial as possible for you to answer in whatever shape or form you feel comfortable. But I know for a fact that the squash community as a whole, including the PSA and the players and everyone else involved, did a lot to get the game in, and it still hasn't happened. And of course, I look at other sports. So as I mentioned to you before we started talking on the podcast, so you look at something like rock climbing or sport climbing, and its popularity has shot through the roof since it was announced that it'll be in Tokyo 2020. Is this barrier negatively impacting squash, and how?
I don't think it's negatively impacting squash, no. I mean, you can look at our tour, and it's thriving as as much as it ever has been. It's the amount of prize money available now in terms of gender equality as well. We've come on leaps and bounds. So us being in the Olympics or not, it's not negative to us at the moment. We've not gone backwards from it. But as you say, it's the frustrating part. There's so many frustrating parts. The biggest one for me is just that the Olympics, I personally don't think they are held as in high regard since introducing certain sports.
Yeah.
And all the controversial stuff that goes on behind the scenes with the IOC,
yeah,
the cloak and daggers stuff. Can't remember what my train of thought was there. Yeah. Sidetracked. That's the fact that, yeah, squash is just, if you sit there and watch a professional squash match, just how it can't be included in what's supposed to be the be-all and end-all of the pinnacle of sports is just beyond me. It's such a physically demanding sport in itself, the gladiatorial aspect of it. I mean, it's one of the hardest sports on the planet. So it's obviously, the Olympic Games is obviously not about sports. It's quite obvious.
Yeah.
We have tried really hard. You can't be too negative about it, you know. It's not the be all and end all, but as you say, like sport climbing, rock climbing, the amount of positivity it can do to a sport through the inclusion in terms of funding, like grassroots level kids. I still do a bittersweet watching the Olympics these days, but I used to absolutely love it, to have a dream of being able to be part of an Olympic Games is just something any little child wants to do. And so it's really tough to take, and it would be absolutely massive if we could get into the Games. And one day we might, one day we won't. I don't know. But in terms of it's not us not being in it isn't a negative thing. On squash is absolutely thriving at the moment, especially on the professional tour. It's just a missed. It's just what could have been what can be if we are in it. That makes sense.
Sure. I think it was Moal Shorbagi who summarized what I thought best about the situation in a tweet a while ago, where he said, look, we're going to play the greatest game on earth. You guys can go and watch breakdancers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it just sums it up, really.
Yeah.
I'm not saying breakdancing isn't physically hard, but I mean, anyway, yes.
Yeah, sure. Well, moving on, since we're on the topic of, I guess, viewership and the growing fan base, do you think that, I've heard a lot about this, for example, so there are often these discussions on squash real estate, so squash courts being better utilized with quotation marks for means to make or generate more income, so building a residential complex or converting it into something else. Do you think this impacts the game? Because obviously, for example, if we take your country, the UK, there were significantly more squash courts there back in the 70s or 80s, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, than there are now.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's been, especially down south, I think. I don't know any statistics or anything like that, but of course you hear of clubs being knocked down for to build, you know, apartments on, because especially in London the land is worth so much. So obviously that's not a good thing for squash, but it's the same in Brisbane. There's the same anywhere, that land is worth a lot of money, especially around city centres. So of course that's not good. It has an impact. In terms of people having residential courts, that's still pretty rare if you step outside of the United States.
Yeah,
I mean, for me, it'd be lovely to have a court at your house. But I think the more, it's tough running a squash club. I've never done it, but I've looked into it, and it's not easy to make money, and it's a lot of hard work by the looks of it. So you have to be a really passionate squash player from a squash background, and that's why you have to appreciate all the people that do run these squash clubs and the effort they put into them for not a huge result financially. I mean, some clubs maybe so, but there's a lot of, and that's why squash is so good, and some squash clubs are so just such a great community to be part of, because it all comes from the love of the sport. No one's fantastic if you can shed load of money from it, but most of the time squash club owners or run tournament promoters, they're in it for the love of the game, and that's why our squash community, I think, is so great.
Absolutely, absolutely. And do you think that, so you did touch on this a bit, and obviously you, as you said, that, you know, with higher winnings at the for winning tournaments and the sort of support that players are getting, the sport is growing in terms of viewership and fan base. But one of the things that I often look at, being in the business that I am, is when I look at social media, Cristiano Ronaldo has a larger following than I think Real Madrid and Barcelona combined on the platform. And that shows you the, I guess, the power or the ability that he has to influence and bring people to football. On the other side, like, I look at squash, and I think there's a couple of players perhaps who are in the 100,000 followers. And this by no means is a means to say that, you know, a sport is popular or not, but it's the ability to influence and for people to gain, or especially the youth, because predominantly on social media like Instagram, the youth uses those kind of platforms. Do you think there's some room there for squash to grow and better utilize these platforms to engage younger audiences to get attracted to the sport?
Yeah, of course. That is something that's been a major objective of the PSA media team. I know that, and especially right now, actually, I think they're doing a great job of, when there's no play, like all sports are having to think of lots and lots of different content and have fun with using the players. They're really, you know, making up trick shots, games, stuff yep. like that. You know, we're never gonna, squash is never gonna have a Cristiano Ronaldo, yep. but we've got it. It just depends. You know, Nicole David, she's got so many followers because yep. of the country she's from, of course, her success, yep. but she's a superstar in her country. And unfortunately, in squash at the moment, because we're not in the Olympics, we don't have a 5-time Olympic gold medalist, which maybe we could have done, and they would have 100,000 followers. Yeah. But again, it's growing so much. I mean, it's the trouble with squash is it has got a big following on social media with all the PSA channels on Instagram, Twitter. They're always doing stuff, but it's all squash fans that follow it. So the trick is trying to get squash outside of its niche fan base to cross over to the general public that don't know too much about it, and make it more attractive, or try and draw them in to get to know the sport better than they do at the moment.
Absolutely. And I envision that us at Sportages, because we do cover several sports including squash, would one day be able to sort of assist squash with achieving that as an overall overarching sport or organization. Yeah. So yeah, that's a very interesting point, and I'm really eager to see how the PSA is able to sort of do this in the coming years. I did want to move on to coaching, and that's obviously what you are up to now that you've retired. What made you take up coaching, and how were you so lucky to end up in the Sunshine State?
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky to live in Brisbane. It's definitely one of the nicer spots in the world.
Yeah.
Coaching, pretty much a natural progression, like most squash players when they retire.
Yeah.
I have coached obviously a little bit here and there, doing the odd camp and the odd little individual in places. And then it's just the natural progression, really. And having been coached for so many years, I still, even though I'm retired, I love the game still, and just the opportunity to try and give something back to the sport, really, and see if, you know, you don't know if you're any good at it or not either. So it's all been, it's been nice. It's been different, and to get on, and I coach different standards of people. At the moment, I'm not coaching whatsoever at all, which is tough.
Yeah.
Because obviously you build up relationships and you get a nice continuity as best as I can, because I still travel emceeing on the world tour.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big hit at the moment with all the squash centres being shut.
Yeah.
But yeah, coaching so far, I've enjoyed just giving something back, and and being on court in a different capacity and not be, you know, squash players tend to be, I don't personally think, so other people might differ in opinion, but I don't think I'm selfish, but as a professional athlete, yeah, you do tend to be a bit, you know, what am I getting out of this session? How am I going to improve this? It's all a bit me. Whereas as a coach, it's nice to just, you know, really try and help someone else instead of subconsciously thinking, what are you getting out of the session?
Yeah.
So that's something that's been enjoyable with the coaching.
Sure, sure. And you obviously brought up the presentation or being a presenter side of things on the world tours. What's that been like for you, and how did you get involved in it? One, and obviously it's significantly different to playing the game. So what was it like transitioning into doing that more regularly?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was 3 years ago at the British Open. Lee Beachell of PSA asked me if I'd fancy, I was still playing at the time, asked me if I'd fancy interviewing the players after their matches.
Yeah.
And at first I was straight away like, why would you ask me to do that?
Yeah.
And then obviously I said yes in the end and gave it a go, and it was pretty nerve-wracking the first event, but it was really like, I'm really grateful that he asked me and I've been given the opportunity to do it, because for the first couple of years I was playing and emceeing. I was also injured for 9 months, so it was I was in and out of the tournaments, and yeah, it's just has been, even though I've retired, I think it's been quite, I don't really feel like I've left the tour that much because I seem to be still at quite a few of the big events emceeing, and it's I'd much rather be playing, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I'm really fortunate to still be involved in that capacity, and it's nice. There's I retired only about a year, coming up a year ago, so I still know a lot of the players, and it is actually genuinely quite nice if you're on court with them straight away and just seeing their faces after they've had a good result, and I've obviously got a bit more, having been a player, a bit more understanding perhaps or empathy with certain situations. And but yeah, it's been good fun. I still get to travel. It's so much harder work than being a player, I find, at tournaments.
Yeah.
It makes you realize what a good life being a professional sports person is, that's for sure. But yeah, I've been enjoying it. Yeah, I'm lucky to do it.
Sure, sure. And just coming back to working with Squash Australia, I did want to ask you about some of the up and coming players in the country here who you rate highly, because, for example, when with my knowledge of squash, when I think Australian squash at its peak, a lot would argue that was Jeff Hunt and Heather McKay, and that was a long time ago. What is in store for the future for squash in Australia?
Yeah, it's a tough one with Squash Australia at the moment, given their pedigree has been so strong up until, you know, at the moment there's going to be a massive drop off at the senior end you've still got Rachel Grinham and Donna
yep.
Lobben
yep.
In the women's, and then you've got Sarah Cardwell, Jess Turnbull, who are a bit younger, but after that there's not really a lot. And in the men's, obviously Pilly and Cusk have just, Ryan Skelly have just retired, so it's mm-hmm. pretty dire straits at the top end.
Yep.
So unfortunately it's going to be a long time before Australia is going to be back on the senior stage, on the map, in the way that they have been in the past. That's not going to happen for a very long time, but that's not to say it can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to be a long wait. And there's definitely some talents out there. There's a couple of the younger boys, Oscar Curtis, Gregory Chan, who've got bags of potential,
yep.
who could have world-class potential at the top end, at the senior end. But again, geographically, it's so hard for the Aussies compared to the likes of me in England growing up. We're all together yeah. playing weekend, weekend out, and obviously not far to travel to events, not too much expense, whereas
mm-hmm.
the kids over here, just to travel into states, I didn't realize until I moved here how expensive that was. And
yeah.
you know, if you got a couple of kids that play and you're taking them, it's very difficult for them. But we had a high performance camp at the start of the year where myself and Stuart Boswell, the new national coach, got mm-hmm. together and got to know all the kids, and they're all great. Really, really nice to meet them all, and there's some talent out there. It's just, it's very different coming from England, and it's just trying to get them to sort of start seeing things a little bit differently. So it's just been a real shame that they've all had to. I mean, I couldn't bear it. If I were thinking of myself when I was 12 years old and I got told I couldn't play squash for 6 months or something, I would really struggle and be devastated, yeah. I think. So it's a shame that that's kind of been paused, yeah. on pause for a bit, but I'm sure they'll all be eager to get back. So they were going to have the World Juniors coming up at the Gold Coast in July, so that's off, yeah. now. But yeah, there's definitely potential out there. It's just trying to get more of it. I think participation in Australia is a big thing, mm-hmm. which of course squash, I mean, it's so hard over here with how good your weather is and everyone wants to be outside, yeah. and stuff. So there's a lot to compete with, a lot of sports, but yeah. obviously it's always been like that and they've always had great players. So I think moving forward, it's just trying to keep communication levels up. From what I've gathered in the short time I've been working here, I big thing for me is just to try and keep communication. Yeah. Between, we might not see each other as much as other countries are able to do due to the size of the country, but for the state coaches to be in touch with the national coaches, mm-hmm. and the players and their parents and their own personal coaches within those states to try and get a line of communication that's consistent throughout the year. So when we do see them at tournaments 3 or 4 times a year, there's already a basis or a level of understanding and relationships between all the people that are involved to help improve that junior player in question.
Sure. It's really interesting because I actually myself hadn't really thought of that. But when you mention it, it makes so much sense that logistically it would be so difficult to get everyone together just because of the size of this country. So really fascinating insight there, Jenny. Thank you for that. Now, being mindful of the time, because obviously I feel like there are tons of more questions that I can ask you, but I wanted to move into the fun section of the podcast.
Okay,
this
sounds good.
Yeah.
I've got an online trivia session coming up.
Oh, okay. This is more. Yeah.
Easier questions, I think.
I'm just gonna ask you very simple questions, and if you could just give me like a one-word response, that would be the way to go. So if you're happy to kick off, we can do that.
Let's do it.
Sure. So first question: favorite squash player of all time.
I thought they were gonna be like tea or coffee. Oh dear. First with just one answer.
Oh, you could give me two or three in that one. Yeah.
I'm just gonna go with one answer, but yeah. Don't read too much for my answers. Cassie Jackman.
Favorite city where you've played.
Crikey. Oh, these are horrendous. Favorite city, just one city.
That you've enjoyed playing in a lot.
I'm going to say it's not a city, but Cayman Islands. I always used to love playing in the Cayman Islands, Georgetown.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Favorite rivalry on the court that you've had?
I'd say Nicole, just because it was such a big challenge for me. We played so many times.
Sure.
I also always enjoyed my matches with my good friend Alison Waters. We always had good matches. So I'll say Al as well.
Sure. And your favorite athlete outside of squash?
There's a few that spring to mind. I'm gonna go with Steven Gerrard.
I felt like
this is one. There's plenty. Plenty.
Sure, but I really felt when you told me that you're a Scouser that this was who you would answer in this question. I sort of knew. But it makes sense. He was an absolutely brilliant player. Do you prefer cardio or strength training?
Ooh, cardio. Actually, I hate running, but I didn't do much strength work back in the day.
Yeah.
But it was something that once I got into a routine of it and started seeing some results,
yeah.
I quite enjoyed it. But I'd go cardio over strength.
Sure. And you brought this one up earlier. And as a since you are a Brit, tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Coffee.
Which is probably quite un-British, but I actually drink much, so it's very un-British. Coffee all day.
Sure. Do you prefer sweet or savory food?
Sweet.
Movie? Yeah. Movies or books?
Movies.
Fantastic. So that's the end of that section, Jenny. Thanks for that. Okay. One last question to cap things off. What do you say to young female athletes who want to get involved in squash and really want to pursue the game as their career?
I'd say absolutely go for it. Anything is possible. And if it was me who is little now, it would be a dream come true seeing all the tournaments that are available to play. It's absolutely an option for any young girl to be a professional squash player. So go for it. Practice as much as you can, have as much fun, watch as much as you can, and go for it, yeah.
Well, you heard it right here, folks. Jenny Duncalf with some phenomenal insights. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure chatting to you and learning so much about your squash experiences and your journey.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's good to talk to you, and well done on everything you're doing to try and spread the word on sport and women's sport as well. So thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. And for the listeners, if you want to check out Jenny's social media, we'll have it attached to this podcast, so you'll be able to go and connect with her, follow her, get in touch, and see how things go. That's it for now.
Forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.